My father could hear a little animal step or a moth in the dark against the screen, and every far sound called his listening out into places where the rest of us had never been. More spoke to him from the soft, wild night than came to our porch for us on the wind. We would watch him look up and his face go keen till the walls of the world flared, widened. My father heard so much that we still stand inviting the quiet by turning the face, waiting for a time when something in the night will touch us too from that other place. I see that this is billed to reading and comment. I'd like to do both, but I wanted to launch into what seemed to me a poem without being too abruptly a poem, trying to make the first one seem almost like a comment and almost like a poem. I have a longer poem about my father, and I think there's a kind of a risk starting with this kind of tone, but I want to read it. It's called Elegy. One reason I wanted to bring it today is it was printed in the Western Review, edited by a person who's going to be here in the fall, Ray West. The responsible sound of the lawnmower puts a net under the afternoon. Closing the refrigerator door, I hear a voice in the other room that starts up color in every cell. Presents like this, Father, I got from you. And there are hundreds more to tell. One night, sound held in cornfield farms drowned in August, and melon flower breath creeping in stealth, we walked west while all the rest of the country slept. I hold that memory in both my arms, how the families there had starved the dogs in the night they waited to be fed. At the edge of dark, there paled a flash. A train came on with its soft tread that roused itself with light and thundered with dragged windows curving down earth's side while the corn stalks whispered. All of us hungry creatures watched until it was extinguished. If only once in all those years the right goodbye could have been said. I hear you climbing up the snow, a brown-clad wanderer on the road with the usual crooked stick, and on the wrong side of the mountains, I can hear the latches click. Remember in the southwest, going down the canyons, we turned off the engine, the tires went hoarse, picking up sound out of turned-away mountains. We felt the secret sky lean down. Suddenly the car came to with a roar. And remember the Christmas wreath on our door when we threw it away and it jumped blue up the fire. At sight of angels or anything unusual, you are to mark the spot with a cross, for I have set out to follow you. And these marked places are expected. But in between, I can hear no sound. The softest push of doors I close may jump to slam in a March wind. When you left our house that night and went falling into that ocean, a message came. Silence. I pictured you going, spangles and bubbles leaving your pockets in a wheel clockwise. Sometimes I look out of our door at night. When you send messages, they come spinning back into sound with just leaves rustling. Come battering. I listen. Am the same. Waiting. It seems to me it takes some kind of rashness, audacity, on the part of an editor to publish a poem that's longer than the kind that fits in a little space in a magazine. So I was very much grateful to Ray West when he would try something this long. I wanted to, because I know I'm speaking to people who are interested in reading and writing in a kind of involved way, a little more about some of the circumstances of poems. And I brought deliberately two poems now I want to try out. One was very recently printed, I mean in the last month or so, in a magazine with prestige, The New Yorker. And it's fun to get into The New Yorker, which I've done a few times, but with many rejections. But it's fun partly because it's like a message to your friends. I suppose about half my friends read The New Yorker. But actually, I want to read this poem, and I want to frame something against it before I read it. I want to read it as an example of something that gets into a prestigious kind of market, but I don't think very much of it. And then I want to read one that I think a lot of that I haven't been able to sell anywhere. So, the one from The New Yorker is this, called When We Looked Back. The most present of all the watchers where we camped were the animals that stood beyond the firelight, being dark but there and making no sound. They were the most remembered eyes that night. Tapestries of fern had taken them in when we walked out in the morning along the track their eyes had bored through the air. And the camp we left was a little spot in the trees when we looked back. I don't like to bite the poem that feeds me, but and for all I know, it's all right, but it's a kind of a limited project, seems to me. It's not that I don't think anyone tries to write limited projects, but after they're done, one should look at them as coldly as possible. I know how this works with gimmicks. I think many things The New Yorker puts in, maybe this is not news to anybody, it's sort of gimmicky stuff. I mean, they have a project, a certain kind of magazine with a certain flavor, and the Stafford poem in this issue was a certain little flavor. Here's one that's been tried so many places I didn't even bother to try to type all the places on it, but everywhere, almost. It's called Homecoming, and I suppose it's a failure, but it's a failure I like myself. Under my hat I custom you intricate, Goldie. At homecoming, I glance and remember your street. What happened to Goldie, they ask, asking too fast. So I fold them off, thousands of answers deep. Nobody saw her after the war. We're driving. In front of the Union Building, we stop and get out. You balanced one night on that step, then leaned. There's Potter's Lake. And there goes our path, down straight. Hello, Paul. Howdy, Tom. Glad to see you again. They shake. It's been a long time, they bellow, by God. I shake. They sing an old song. I hunt a face. Every voice yells in my ear. She's married or dead. Oh, all you revelers, back of the songs you're singing, they've torn down Goldie's house. You've forgotten it. And Goldie's lost, who brightened all our class. And I stand here, home come, to celebrate. Under my hat I custom you intricate, Goldie, passing the places, betraying them all with a wave, adding past dates and jobs that led us apart, flickering into revolving doors till I've lost you. What happened to Goldie? Where does she live? Remember, Tom, she's that girl we once spoke of. One time, quite a number of years ago, a fellow I'd heard about named John Malcolm Brennan was putting out he was editing one of those new writings or something, and friend of mine wrote, good friend, turned out, said that Brennan will publish that poem of yours, Homecoming, if you get it to him in time. So I burned up the mail, but It either wasn't in time or there's still something very much wrong with it, but I still like it. One time I got into trouble with this poem, sort of. Person introduced to me on one of the few public occasions, with praise, and this was the first one on the program that sounded sort of like a slam at him, called Following. This was published in Poetry Magazine. There dwelt in a cave, and winding, I thought, lower, a rubber bear that overcame his shadow. And because he was not anything but good, he served all sorts of pretzel purposes. When I met plausible men who called me noble, I fed them to the bear, and bulge, rear, the shadow never caught up with his girth, as those talkers never caught up with their worth. And bear and I often went wild and frivolous, following a way that we would create or claim, but we had to deal sometimes with the serious who think they find the way when the way finds them. In their deliberate living, all is planned, but they forget to squeak sometimes when the wheel comes round. Bear and I, and other such simple fellows, just count on the wheel, and the wheel remembers the sound. When Leonard Nathan wrote up something about some of the poems, he quoted a little bit from one called The Farm on the Great Plain. And this I'd like to read and confess. To me, it's a puzzling poem. I've often wished that people who write would tell me things like this about what they write, sort of on the level. What does it mean to you, and how does it happen? This is a kind of a mysterious poem to me. I like it pretty well. It appeared in Poetry Magazine, The Farm on the Great Plain. A telephone line goes cold. Birds tread it wherever it goes. A farm back of a great plain tugs an end of the line. I call that farm every year, ringing it, listening, still. No one is home at the farm. The line gives only a hum. Some year, I will ring the line on a night at last, the right one, and with an eye tapered for braille, from the phone on the wall, I will see the tenant who waits, the last one left at the place. Through the dark, my braille eye will lovingly touch his face. Hello, is mother at home? No one is home today. But father, he should be there. No one is here. But you, are you the one? Then the line will be gone, because both ends will be home. No space, no birds, no farm. Myself will be the plain, wise as winter is gray, pure as cold posts go pacing toward what I know. I don't know what people do about things that occur to them to say, which still seem all right when they're not at all sure it will seem all right to other people. And one of the things that I do is I carry it around a little bit as far as I can, so as to satisfy other people. I mean, as far as I can without hurting somehow. I don't know how to define this point, but often it surprisingly can go into some kind of standard form. And then after that's done, I just have to let it go, sort of. And I do understand this now in other people. I've heard about it all my life. I understand. After a while, there are things you just don't want to salvage if the cost of salvaging them is some kind of death. And this, I didn't know whether I had it curried or not, but Henry Rego, I think it was at Poetry Magazine, decided to try it. I'd like to read a curried poem, a mechanical poem. I think this poem could be written from the rules in the composition book. I don't like it any the less for that myself. I think it's a pretty neat performance. But I feel differently about it from the way I feel about the farm on the Great Plain, in which I was just sort of tugged along through that poem. This one I made the way the rules say, with vivid speech and so on, called A Survey. Down in the frantic mountains, they say a canyon winds, crammed with hysterical water, hushed by placid sands. They tried to map that country, sent out a field boot crew, but the river surged at night and ripped the map in two. So they sent out wildcats, printed with intricate lines of fur, to put their paws with such finesse the ground was unaware. Now only the wildcats know it, patting a tentative paw, soothing the hackles of ridges, pouring past rocks and away. The sun rakes that land each morning. The mountains buck and scream. By night, the wildcats pad by, gazing it quiet again. Survey made out of Ford Company interchangeable parts, I'd say. Ford's a good car. What's that? Yes, this was published also on poetry. Do I have them according to rules or inspiration, you say? Oh. I guess the honest thing to do is to say I don't really know about that, but one would think the rules would help, but I don't know. I sort of doubt it, and I see I've got myself sort of involved in how this is done and the other one was done because of this. Once this got started, down in the frantic mountains, they say a canyon winds, I felt more mechanical about it and I knew what to do. That is, a word comes, don't take the first one, but see if something more frantic won't come. But that too has a kind of elation to it. So for all I know, there's a leading in this kind of writing, as well as in the other kind. But I feel a difference, and I guess I really can't tell. But I could say one thing more. Your question about where it was published would be of significance to me. I would expect it to make a difference. And I can't tell about Poetry Magazine. I have a poem that I might try later from Poetry Magazine. I've sold poems even to a place like the Ladies' Home Journal, where I'd expect it to have to be a certain way. And I was surprised. But one they bought several years ago never has appeared. I think they discovered their mistake after they paid. And sometimes I've tried even audacious things, you know, and send them something that I sort of just dare them to take. And sometimes it works. But this happens after the poem's written. All the marketing is after the poem's written. I'd like to read, though, speaking about Down in the Frantic Mountains. This started from a dream. I dreamed when we were traveling through New Mexico. I woke with a dream in my mind and just a phrase in it. We come from the Straight River country, or something like that. Well, Straight Rivers might be fine in its place, but that made me think of the Frantic Mountains when I looked around and started. This one, in the Oregon country, and after all, I'm an emissary from the wilds and should try to do something about that, came from looking at a map of Oregon, which is jumping with all kinds of possibilities. from old Fort Walla Walla and the Klickitats to Umpqua near Port Orford, stinking fish tribes massacred our founders, the thieving whites. Chief Rottenbelly slew them at a feast. Kamiakin riled the snakes and Yakimaws. All spurted arrows through the Cascades west. Those tribes became debris on their own land. Captain Jack's wide face above the rope, his Modoc women dead with twitching hands. The last and the most splendid, nay per se, Chief Joseph, fluttering eagles through Idaho, dashed his pony-killing getaway. They got him. Repeating rifles bored at his head, and in one fell look, Chief Joseph saw the game out of that spiral mirror all explode. Back of the Northwest map, their country goes, mountains yielding and hiding fold on fold, gorged with yew trees that were good for bows. This was in the Hudson Review. Yes, that was published in the Hudson Review. And maybe everyone who's tried this sort of thing has speculated about addresses and publication. I know Harper's Magazine is looking for somebody besides Neuberger who could write about the Northwest. And I suspect that I've never met anyone from Hudson Review staff, and they've been cordial and helpful, and that doesn't mean just praising in their replies. So I don't want to indict anyone, but I suspect the place might have made a difference. When I was trying to write articles, I never did have any luck with articles till I was at the University of Wisconsin and could send them out from the center of all that research about agriculture and so on, and it sounded so authentic. I began to sell articles. And this is an Oregon poem by an Oregon poet, I guess. There's a fellow I want to mention, a fellow named Richard Ashman, showed up like an angel down in New Orleans with a magazine called the New Orleans Poetry Journal. And he would respond fast and with discrimination, it seemed to me, and by poems. And he published a poem I liked called Thinking for Berkey, that I want to read now. In the late night, listening from bed, I have joined the ambulance or the patrol screaming toward some drama, the kind of end that Berkey must have someday if she isn't dead. The wildest of all, her father and mother cruel, farming out there beyond the old stone quarry where high school lovers parked their lurching cars. Berkey learned to love in that dark school. Early, her face was turned away from home toward any hard-working place. But still, her soul, with terrible things to do, was alive, looking out for the rescue that surely someday would have to come. Windiest nights, Berkey, I have thought for you. And no matter how lucky I've been, I've touched wood. There are things not solved in our town, though tomorrow came. There are things time passing can never make come true. We live in an occupied country, misunderstood. Justice will take us millions of intricate moves. Sirens will hunt down Berkey, you quiet in your beds, while in the night you lie so far and good. There's an ingredient that, well, start back a little bit. I'd think people that appear on this series would have some kind of obligation to do the best they even desperately can in writing and bring the poems. And then if any comment seems to me helpful, kind of comment, would be to try to to place themselves, even though this would seem just quaint to you, yet their attempts to place themselves might be of interest. I'd like to try to identify one kind of writing a little bit. The motivation back of it is a kind of social unrest motivation, I guess. I was in college in the 30s. In a way, this is I've come to realize in teaching, college teaching, there's some kind of watershed, maybe several kinds, between the 30s and now. And at the end of the 30s, a calamity came that for many of us, well, we're just not accommodated to it yet, and probably never will be. And this poem sort of comes from that. It's called Watching the Jet Planes Dive. We must go back and find a trail on the ground, back of the forest and mountain, on the slow land. We must begin to circle on the intricate sod. By such wild beginnings, without help, we may find the small trail on through the buffalo bean vines. We must go back with noses and the palms of our hands and climb over the map in far places everywhere and lie down whenever there's doubt and sleep there. If roads are unconnected, we must make a path, no matter how far it is or how lowly we arrive. We must find something forgotten by everyone alive and make some fabulous gesture when the sun goes down, as they do by custom in little Mexico towns where they crawl for some ritual up a rocky steep. The jet planes dive. We must travel on our knees. On the train yesterday, coming down through all that fine scenery so much advertised in the Shasta Daylight, I was reading a book when I got enough of Oregon scenery by a language man named Saper. Wonderful book, published by the University of California Press. In one of the essays, he talked about the function of language, and he said language helps us. It has a certain function. It places us really and psychologically in our society in contrast to the official and institutional placements our society puts upon us. And as I understood him, the language is full of little cues and clues so that we recognize each other in ways entirely too complex for anyone to analyze. When we meet, we begin to vector in towards some kind of meeting from tone, gesture. I suddenly stop when I realize I'm saying this, and choice of words and so on. In this, I thought of it in this poem because, well, it veers away from the utterly standard idiom of English, which those of us who have lived in the country know. They say by the time we're five, we're experts. And we immediately recognize each other, parts of the country and so on. To say something like, by custom in little Mexico towns, I don't want to make my case depend on one little syllable, the difference between Mexico and Mexican, but there's a kind of a deliberate deviation for me in that word, a kind of deliberate recklessness maybe. That was Poetry Magazine again. This just happens. This was published in a magazine published at San Jose until recently called Talisman, called The Research Team in the Mountains. We found a certain heavy kind of wolf. Haven't seen it, though. Just know it. Answers are just echoes, they say, but a question travels before it comes back, and that counts. Did you know that everything is free here? We found days that wouldn't allow price on anything. When a dirty river and a clean river come together, the result is dirty river. If your policy is to be friends in the mountains, a rock falls on you. The only real friends, you can't help it. Many go home having conquered a mountain. They leave their names at the top in a jar for snow to remember. Looking out over the campfire at night again this year, I pick a storm for you, again the first one. We climbed Lostine and Chief Joseph Canyons. Finally, in every canyon, the road ends. Above that, storms of stone. Some of these words, Lostine, Chief Joseph, this is the Wallawas in northeastern Oregon, an utterly wild place. And I was charmed by some of the names like Lostine Canyon, which we went up by car and then by horse and then by foot. And it did end in a storm of stone. But I asked, where did this name Lostine come from? Such a good name. They said it was named after a little town in Kansas. Over in Montana, if you try to beeline out of any place in northern Oregon and head for the east without coming south, some people are audacious enough to do this, your choices are very few if you look at the map. One way is you can go up past Coeur d'Alene and Missoula, and then you have some options over there in Montana down into Wyoming. And on one of those ways, I think it's over in Gallatin Valley. Oh, well, it couldn't be that, but in that area, there's the Valley of the Little Bighorn. And out there in the wilderness, there's the Custer Battlefield. And I'm enough of a calendar art person to get excited about this place. We got out and looked it over, and I wrote a poem. It was in the Saturday Review, called At the Custer Monument. They buried the soldiers where they fell. Their markers go sudden and white. In the Valley of the Little Bighorn, history explodes into quiet. While the grass grows, the land is yours. But gold brought in the miners, and Custer was pushed toward Crazy Horse to a meeting this grass remembers. The wounded cried water all afternoon. Spilling down the hillside go scattered markers of volunteers who tried for the river that night. Where Crazy Horse rode like a flung war bonnet, fluttering at the white man, reminding the grass a low wind cuts through the Valley of the Little Bighorn. I don't know if it's an exciting place, and and excitement about a place is one of the things that can happen to a person. And it is dramatic. They didn't make the cemetery with a plan, but they did bury the people where they fell. So as you look at that, and that's what it says, and you look at that battlefield and see the white markings, there are some lunges out here and there scattered around. It's a dramatic thing. And it's all so quiet. And there's that grass and the wind and all the tradition that everyone knows about. I remember at Iowa, Leonard, I don't think you remember this, but I wrote this poem. This was in the 50s. I went back there. And it was pretty strenuously criticized, especially at the end, because of kind of romantic, the wind is on the side of the Indians feeling at the end. I understand this. I tried to do what I could about it. But then, when I moved away from Iowa, I published it. when we lived back in Indiana, we rented a house, a big house, many bedrooms, even one room that we called the wrestling room. We put old mattresses on upstairs floor, and when the kids got too wild, they could go up and wrestle. And the man who owned this old-fashioned house, it had a number in these new days, but they all identified it by the old Hamer place, they call it. Well, the man who owned the house was a minister in Huntington, Indiana. He came to visit us a couple of times, and he brought his wife. He helped her out of the car. She'd had a stroke. And I wrote a short poem. This was in the Saturday Review, called Strokes. The left side of her world is gone. The rest, sustained by memory and a realization. There are still the children. Going down our porch steps, her pastor calls back. We are proud of her recovery, and there is a chiropractor up in Galesburg. The birthdays of the old require such candles. I have here the nearest I could come. I wasn't trying to come near, but after I looked at it, I realized I'd veered sort of near a kind of San Francisco. Now, I have to discriminate here. Up north, they would say a kind of San Francisco style. I realize that's a terrible thing to say. any city is various. But one identifiable influence from San Francisco, for better or worse, in the far north, could be linked to a certain prevailing spirit, I think, possibly, in this poem. It's called Action. And it appeared in New Mexico Quarterly this spring. The bolo is a knife you grab at the awkward end and swing till it whistles a wind that brings back flowers in the fall. You whirl the wind through the streets to straighten it all. Or you go dancing and break a champagne glass. Many a life can be saved by mistakes like this. The arm freely swings, you lean and escape opposite from the whirlwind. For today, reading signs faster than signs can be read is not fast enough. Start at the other end and go by sound. Listen, like bats in crisis when they dodge things by dusk that widen the face. Shadows begin to knife through the dark. You claw the wing wider for turns. Don't wait. Whisper, bolo, and swing toward the mark. I have some friends who are radicals back east. They published a magazine called Liberation. And they remembered me from the old days when they thought I was a radical, I guess. They wrote me a note. Now I'm a teacher. They wrote me a note and said, submit some things. So I did. And I was away from a college where I'd been teaching, but someone had written me a letter inviting me to a testimonial dinner for the president of that college. I didn't feel like going. I wrote a poem called On Being Invited to a Testimonial Dinner and sent it to Liberation. They published it. This magazine never circulates, for it'll cause me any trouble. We are trained and quiet intellectuals who learn all mazes very well. And in the dusk we live in, go around the room and part way up the walls. If there is a way around, we flow. If there's no way, our heads know. Blundering types who push, we can forgive, being sure that such and such makes a so-and-so. But no man, forceful or not, can live with credit in our minds at all till we've checked what he is against all his pretenses. And no forceful man commands our love. Now the power in thought lives by surprise. A heart may feel beforehand. It decides whatever way it wishes, but a head may change in the midst of kings to stay wise. There was once in the jungle a feast where great men fed. The cobra sought to hold on his still head the ark of dignity for all the kings, whereby with his assurance their great worth was held, returned regrets. I can't accept, was his reply, for my head lives by freedom, low or high. And though my heart acts tame in the midst of kings, my head may twitch for itself, and those kings die. I want to end with a kind of peculiar maneuver, because I represent an area that's culturally backward. I identify with it. I'm culturally backward. So that's why I can say this recklessly, even though I see a few people here who have been in Oregon and might be there again through some kind of duress. This state has a centennial this year. It's a big thing. And they offered prizes for poems. And I wrote a poem carefully for the prize. Mechanical poem. And still, it's like a confession at the last. I want to read two sections from that poem. I have it all timed here right, and the color of it doesn't make any difference. It just happens to be the color of the paper I bought up in British Columbia and began to write poems on. We asked an old-timer, a literary man in Oregon, what shall we do to win the prize? It was $250, you know. A lot of money, enough making it worthwhile to stop and take thought like a cobra. He said, don't calculate at all, just write the best you can. This seemed a little grim to us. We wanted more guidance than that, but that's, I think, what happened, actually. So I wrote a poem, though, called Memorials of a Tour Around Mount Hood, and the title, at least, was kind of recognition of some ingredients that wouldn't do any harm in Oregon. But I put together a poem that would be long enough so they'd notice it. The limit was 50 lines, and it got up into 40-some lines, so they'd know I was really trying. And wrote the two sections here are the ones I want to read. I like them myself, so all this preliminary about culturally backward area and so on is just to enable you to say with all the security you want to, that's right. but I like to try to prove that we tried. The first one's called At a Pioneer Cemetery. This is supposed to be stops as you go around the Hood Loop, they call it. This is one of the stops. Both sides fought stillness, but stillness came. Flintlock, war cry, now no name. Dust holds them. Restful grass grows high. Together they grapple the real enemy. Overhead, fighting to break the sky, planes trace our permanence today. They can't go fast enough not to go away. And the second one, stop, was from, I don't have the title here I used in the sequence, but from the at the filling station, you know, one of these filling stations with zoos to attract the kids, so you have to buy gasoline there even if it costs more. There they have such zoos, and it's called From the Cage at one of those filling stations. In the turn of neck, a wolverine offered over one shoulder for his lost freedom. The world said, smoke ought to have a home. People were talking. The wolverine listened clear back to his tail. His body said, remember homeless ones. These discontinuous gestures, resting their paws on a wall, follow the thoughtful who turn, alerted for an instant. Smoke really ought to have a home. That's all.